Registration Center, 2730 Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue, Southeast DC. More information and registration can be found online, PACA, that's P-A-C-A, crimebilltownhall.eventbrite.com. WPFW is your station for jazz and justice, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
The Pacifica National Board and the WPFW Local Station Board will be voting on a proposed Pacifica Bylaws Amendment between July 10th and August 24th of 2024. Information on the amendment, about how vacancies are filled on local station boards, and about the process will be posted on the pacifica.org website.
I'm Muzza Muntali, host of African Now, and you're tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington.
At 89.3 FM, WPFW, Washington. Also on WPFWFM.org. And you're listening in this hour to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. Our topic today, PFAS, the forever chemicals. Toxic forever chemicals, PFAS, are a serious environmental issue linked to multiple health harms. They are used in hundreds of commercial and industrial products, and even present in the drinking water throughout the nation and the world. What should be done regarding these chemicals? To help us answer that question, Dr. Anna Reed is the director of PFAS Advocacy Environmental Health for the Natural Resources Defense Council, also commonly known as NRDC. She works at the intersection of science and policy to reduce and eliminate harmful exposures to toxic chemicals for the safety of people and the environment. As NRDC's lead scientist on PFAS, she conducts research and develops innovative scientific tools and freely available resources to support wider understandings of PFAS science. Prior to joining the Healthy People and Thriving Communities team at NRDC, she worked in the California State Senate as a policy fellow with the California Council on Science and Technology. Dr. Reed received her PhD in developmental biology from the University of California, San Francisco. Welcome, Dr. Reed, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I understand PFAS as, let me see if I can get this right, per or polyfluoral alkyl substances.
Correct, and, yes. Okay. That's why we abbreviate it to PFAS. It's a very long
So what are these? What are these forever chemicals, and how pervasive and persistent are they?
Yes. So PFAS are now a very, very large group of related chemicals. They are defined by being organic molecules that are fluorinated. And the reason why that's important is that everyday normal organic molecules that we're used to, you know, that are part of our bodies, that are in our environment, that don't cause us any problems, are characterized by carbon-hydrogen bonds. But what we've done is switch those hydrogens out for fluorines, which is not a naturally occurring chemistry that makes these molecules incredibly durable. So there's no natural way to degrade these chemicals in our environment or in our bodies. That property
of sunlight, heat, none of those factors really.
Yes. So general estimates of how long they can survive in the environment under typical conditions is in the hundreds of thousands of years. So they really are very, very resistant to degradation. Kind of think of them like plastics, right? So, you know, when we make plastics, they don't go away. They just, you know, eventually degrade over time into smaller and smaller bits of plastic as they break down. But then we now know that those little microplastics are a huge problem and they don't go away. And they're ending up in our bodies as well.
If you allow
if
you allow me, I just add styrofoam.
Yes.
Is a very persistent substance in our environment.
Right.
It
is a problem in how we are managing chemicals in general in our society, is that we only really think about the performance aspect of them, what we're going to use them for in industry or in, you know, commerce. And we don't really spend a lot of time trying to understand what the repercussions of making and using these chemicals are for our health or for the environment long term. And PFAS are the kind of the poster child of what's wrong with how we approach chemical regulation at this point. They were first developed in the 1940s, and their use and broadly quickly expanded since then. They were first developed for Scotchgard and Teflon, so think nonstick pans and spraying your couch to make sure that you could spill red wine on it and nothing would happen. Unfortunately, there are a lot of long-term consequences to that chemistry. Since then, the class has expanded from a few chemicals to thousands of chemicals, and the uses have expanded from those one or two into hundreds of different types of uses across the economy. But because they are so persistent, what we started making in 1940s is probably still in our environment today. And so those levels have increased over time dramatically. So much so that everywhere we measure for PFAS, we usually find it. There was a recent study that looked at levels of PFAS in rainwater across the globe and found rainwater at levels higher than the EPA has set in terms of health thresholds. So we're really beyond the capacity of handling more PFAS in our environment right now. And because they're everywhere, we're finding them in our bodies. So national monitoring shows that about 98% of us have PFAS in our blood. And that's a real big problem because now we understand a lot more about the health effects associated with PFAS exposure than we did before.
So
they're considered systemic toxicants, which means that they affect multiple different organs and systems in our bodies instead of just one target. And what that means is that when I give you the list, it's very long. They are associated with increased risks of cancers, specifically kidney and testicular cancer, but also there's evidence now for breast and pancreatic cancer as well. They suppress our immune system, so it means that we have a harder time defending ourselves against viruses and bacteria and other pathogens. They are associated with reproductive and developmental harms, so infertility, low birth weight, damage to our livers and kidney function, increases in cholesterol levels, which is associated with cardiovascular disease. Just a very, unfortunately, long list of different health effects associated with exposure.
And we've talked about the human body, but is there anything we should note about damage to the environment
Absolutely. So PFAS not only accumulate in our bodies, but they accumulate in the environment in general. And we found them at very high levels in wildlife and fish. And they have also are having health effects associated with being exposed to PFAS. They also accumulate in plants. And it's interesting, some PFAS accumulate more in plants versus humans and animals than others. So there's a different profile that we need to start looking for. But it also is a big concern in terms of it now contaminating our food web. So you can't buy yourself out of PFAS, unfortunately. It is one of those issues where even if you were able to make sure that every single product in your home doesn't have PFAS, you probably would still be exposed through your food and your water. We can treat PFAS out of water, which is really good news, especially considering that the EPA recently finalized drinking water standards for 6 PFAS. So their estimate is about 109 million people across the U.S. will be benefiting from these new standards. But there's no real good way to filter out PFAS from our food web. So that really requires us to dramatically reduce our use of PFAS if we're going to improve that situation.
So this begs a question. Are there particular concerns that there's certain concentrations in certain communities, obviously disadvantaged communities, and I'm imagining all sorts of chemical plants placed in communities of low income and communities of color?
Yes. What we know about PFAS sources, contamination sources, supports your concerns. We know that PFAS were used heavily in firefighting foam from previously. We now have safer alternatives in use, but for decades, PFAS were used in firefighting foam that was used by the Department of Defense and also by airports and in fire training facilities. The health concerns associated with PFAS were hidden for a very long time, so firefighters did not know that when they used the foam and just let it seep into the ground after practicing, that they were creating a huge environmental public health issue. So any DOD airport facility or fire training facility is likely a source of PFAS contamination, unfortunately, and there's a lot across the country. But on top of that, places where PFAS are produced, are heavily contaminated, as well as landfills where all of the products that have PFAS have been accumulating for decades, and that has been seeping out slowly and contaminating the groundwater and other areas around these landfill facilities for a long time. And then incinerators. So if you incinerate PFAS, you don't actually get rid of them. You might break them apart a little bit and change the different forms of PFAS that are being emitted through the air. But you haven't actually been able to destroy PFAS the way current incinerators run. And communities of color or low-income communities are often near landfills or incinerators or chemical plants. And sometimes also, I mean, the DOD sites are a little bit different, but generally a lot of the areas that are known sources of PFAS contamination are more likely to be situated near these communities. There was a recent study from Harvard and other scientists that looked at proximity of communities to these types of sources that we know are PFAS, are more likely to have PFAS contamination. And they did see a direct correlation between communities of color and low-income communities being sited near these sources.
Well, you mentioned Department of Defense sites. Mm-hmm. Have there been any studies regarding veterans or personnel?
So there are some efforts now to study blood levels in firefighters in the DOD and to follow the health effects that are associated with them. In general, firefighters have much higher risk of cancer than the general population. In fact, the International Agency of Research on Cancer lists firefighting as a carcinogenic job. So normally this agency lists chemicals as whether or not they are carcinogenic, but they've actually, this is separate, and have listed being a firefighter as a high risk of having, of getting cancer. I think right now the current estimate is they are twice as likely as the rest of us to get cancer. And that is from a lot of different reasons, but PFAS is one of them.
And I just want to reintroduce you to our listeners. Listeners, you're listening to We the People right here at Pacifica's WPFW FM, 89.3 FM. I'm your host, David Whetstone, but more importantly, Dr. Anna Reed is talking to us about PFAS, the forever chemicals. So, and you're mentioning the firefighters. I imagine probably in fire conditions, the chemicals get particularized and distributed. And that's one of the increased risk. Maybe take a moment in my research, and I think NRDC and other environmental concerns and even government records, AstroTurf, guitar strings, soil remediation agents, possibly perfumes, thermal receipts. We mentioned the firefighting foam, nonstick cookware we mentioned, and food packaging. All those could, and more, could contain PFAS. Now, I guess since we're on the geography, I want to tell listeners you're based and you've done work primarily in California, but do you want to give us perspectives about California, the nation, or any areas of concern?
Sure. So we work both, we work at the international, federal, and state level at really trying to figure out what the best way to move forward on protections for people against, being further exposed to these chemicals. In California, we've made a lot of progress, specifically on a couple of things. California was one of the first states to support a class-based approach to PFAS. So what we mean by a class-based approach is that we would manage PFAS together as one group versus one at a time. And the reason why this is important is because what we've seen over the years is that we will start to realize that a chemical is of concern, that it possibly could be causing harm to our health. And as we start to investigate that, the chemical industry decides to quickly switch to a very similar, different type of chemical, but very similar, right? And so now we have to play catch up and switch our research and our regulatory efforts to a very similar chemical. And that keeps us always behind. We're never able to actually act on a timescale that protects public health. But they have been able to quickly switch to another type of related chemical that allows them to do basically the same thing that they need to function wise. And we will get on this, what we often call toxic treadmill, or sometimes people call it whack-a-mole, but there's a lot of different terms for basically regrettable substitutions where we go from one chemical to another and it's not a better substitution. PFAS are really a good case of this. So when PFOA, which is used to make Teflon, we started to realize that was a problem. Industry switched to Gen X. Which is a very similar looking molecule, except for has, one or two different atoms that are different. And what we found out after, decades of research is that it causes very similar health harms to our bodies. And so what we've done is advocate for basically treating all PFAS the same when we're trying to reduce the use of them. And California actually was one of the first states to do that, where they regulated PFAS as a class in carpets and rugs. We also did this legislatively by banning PFAS in firefighting foam, in food packaging, in textiles, so clothing and other types of textiles in our homes, in juvenile products, and in cosmetics. So we started to tackle categories of products where we knew PFAS were being used, and we knew that they didn't need to be used anymore, either because there was a safer alternative, as in the case of firefighting foam, or we just really didn't need to use PFAS in that that category. Think juvenile products. We don't need PFAS in our juvenile products. We don't need them to be increasing that extra risk to our infants and children.
Yeah, I gleaned from your report that up to 26 million Californians approximately 64% of the population, and that figure may change, please correct me if it has, have been found to have their drinking water infested with PFAS.
Yeah, so the state of California has also been doing a lot of monitoring in drinking water, much more than was required federally. And so we have a lot more data in California than we do in other states.
Is that particularly difficult, or just to give listeners a notion of this?
It is definitely a test that is not, it's becoming more common because of the concern, but testing for PFAS chemicals does cost money. And it's not, because it wasn't regulated before, states had taking the extra effort to that states have had to do to require their drinking water systems to test for a PFAS. It is really important, but it's only been seen in states that have been more progressive about addressing the problem. So we've seen certain states like Michigan, California, New York, New Jersey be really active in this front. And there's a lot of really good monitoring and testing in those states, not so much in other states. Other states, it's very hard to understand who is being exposed to PFAS in their drinking water or not. That's going to change. So over the next couple of years, the EPA is requiring all drinking water systems serving over 3,300 people to test for 29 different types of PFAS in their water. And so we're going to understand a lot better the PFAS contamination situation across our nation soon. Also, with the drinking water standards being finalized, every single public water system will now have to test for those six that are being regulated. So this is a big change in our understanding, but for years, it was really only those handful of states that were taking a really proactive stance on trying to understand what water systems had PFAS contamination.
Well, you mentioned six, and I don't mean to be a contrary interviewer, but we're talking about thousands of different chemicals,
yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
How is six a good beginning? How does a six inform us about dealing with a problem, pardon the expression, more globally? Or
yes.
in a more holistic fashion, rather.
So I think we have to think about this step both as a really big, important first step in protecting people from PFAS in drinking water, but also, as you said, there needs to be a lot more. It's just the first step. There's a big problem here, and there's a lot more chemicals that we could be exposed to than those six. Those six were chosen mainly based off of the amount of data we have on them, both in terms of testing and drinking water, and also in terms of their effects on our health. Two of them are the most famous legacy chemicals, PFOA and PFOS. And those are, we have enough information to know that they are carcinogenic, and EPA treats chemicals that can cause cancer very seriously, and has a goal of zero for exposure in our drinking water. What that means is they've found no safe level of exposure in our drinking water. So those standards were set at what they've determined to be technically feasible, the lowest we can get them, based off of what we can, how we can detect them in our water. The other four are mainly replacement chemicals for PFOA or PFOS, but they were kind of the first round of replacement chemicals. Because PFOA and PFOS were the first used, they are generally the most prevalent in our environment. And so that's a good thing in terms of them being regulated, because that covers a lot of drinking water systems that have PFAS contamination. So I think I mentioned before, 105 million people will likely get their water treated from this new standards. And the great thing is that the treatment required for treating those chemicals is really advanced. And so it will actually treat out not just those six, but likely a lot of other PFAS, if there are other PFAS in people's water, and other types of contaminants like disinfection byproducts. So it's going to be a real big step up in our drinking water infrastructure across the country. But we've done some testing. We worked with community members across the country to test their water for 70 PFAS. So I mentioned before, EPA has test methods for only 29. So we went with a commercial lab that tests for a lot more. We tested for 70. And what we found were 26 different PFAS across our sampling, and 12 of them are not monitored for by the EPA right now. So we're already very behind, even though we've taken this big step. And
is it because the EPA's, this is a new ruling, a new action?
I think that there's just a tendency to concentrate on what we know. This is also not just the EPA, but the scientific community still studies a lot of the legacy PFAS and not the newer ones. And it's also because we are always playing catch up to industry. They know what they're producing and don't have to report that or don't have to share much information with us as to what they're currently doing now. We're always kind of figuring out what's happening afterwards by testing for what's in our drinking water and then actually having to reverse engineer what it is that we're seeing. We'll just see a big spike of like organic fluorine and we don't know what it is. And people actually have to figure out what it is. I mean, it takes them years to do that. So going back to that test, what we did was we also looked at what the community members' water, which ones would actually qualify for protections under these new standards and which wouldn't. And most of the community members that had PFAS in their drinking water would qualify for protections, would actually exceed these new standards. But we found a few communities, I think, where there's newer types of PFAS being used that had actually quite a bit of PFAS in their water and did not have those typical, those legacy PFAS. So they would not fall under these new protections. And some of them were really in places that already have a lot of other types of pollution that they're dealing with. And so that's a big concern. One of them was in Texas, in Houston, Texas area. They have a lot of other petrochemical manufacturing and use in that area. And then on top of that, now they had like 80 parts per trillion of various different new types of PFAS, but not the traditional ones. So their water would not qualify for drinking water treatment.
So we're talking to Dr. Anna Reed about PFAS, the forever chemicals, and you're listening to We the People right here on WPFW. We're coming up on our break where we're going to do public service announcements, but let me squeeze in some touch point questions given the last few things you were saying. One, does the U.S. Toxic Substance Chemical Control Act require chemical data to be reported? Two, I think about both the scientific but the layperson's arguments about how much presence, how many, you know, how much, what's the amount that's so dangerous? I'll limit it to the two questions since we're coming quickly up onto the break.
Some reporting, chemical reporting, is required. I think it's not enough. So if you asked me to provide the data to understand whether or not a chemical is safe or not before putting it on the market, I would require a lot more than what is being required by the Toxic Substance Control Act. That we just do not require enough testing ahead of time before we permit chemicals into our market.
All right.
Do we have time for the second one?
I think that's a sufficient answer. Maybe we'll cover the second part after our break. Listeners, you're again listening to 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. The program's We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone. More importantly, Dr. Anna Reed is talking about PFAS, the forever chemicals. We're coming up in our halfway point of our show, so I'd like to take a break in service to you, and then thanks for your support, to play these public service announcements, and we'll be right back after this. Please stick with us. And welcome back to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone, right here at WPFW. 47 years old, bringing you jazz and justice, Pacifica Foundation radio station, 50,000 watts strong, emanating out of Washington, D.C. More importantly, the engine that keeps us going is you, the listener. Support us in our entirety. We are not sponsored or underwritten by any corporate or commercial entities. And that is a good thing. It gives us a tremendous freedom to investigate issues, to serve you, to connect with you much, much better. We try to build a better world one broadcast at a time. Hopefully that contributes to the betterment of yourselves and your communities. Dr. Anna Reed, thank you for joining us. Dr. Reed is the Director of PFAS Advocacy, Environmental Health for the Natural Resources Defense Council, commonly referred to by its initials NRDC. And we're talking about PFAS, the forever chemicals. So I was asking you before we went to our break about what's often argued among scientists, but mostly everyday people, lay people who are concerned about how the environment affects them. We're talking about chemicals of concern that affect human health, environmental conditions, and physical threats. And PFAS certainly fits as a chemical of concern. So the arguments are, we hear these reports and we hear about these incredibly small particles. So, what's too much? What's too little?
Yeah, it's a really good question.
That's the way the argument usually goes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So I mentioned before EPA has set drinking water standards for six of these chemicals in the parts per trillion level. So that's one drop of water in about 20 Olympic sized pools. So really, really, really low. And that reflects their potential for harm. I often talk about the difficulty in explaining what it means to understand risk for chemicals that cause long-term effects, right? I think it's a lot easier for the layperson to understand that a chemical is harmful if you are immediately sent to the emergency room and you have an acute reaction to that chemical. But it's a lot harder to understand and a lot harder to study chemicals that increase our risk of health harms over years, right? So these are things that we think about with like cancer. One of the most famous examples, and actually took a very long time for the health community to fully explain the risk of, is smoking, right? So it took a very long time for people to understand that if you smoke a cigarette, you're not going to end up in the hospital right away. But if you smoke over a long period of time, you really increase your risk of getting lung cancer or other types of health effects associated with smoking. But it doesn't guarantee, and there's no specific amount of smoking that's going to cause lung cancer, right? We can't give you that answer because everybody is different. Everybody's body is a little bit different. They respond to chemicals a little bit different than everybody else. And also everybody has a very different life story, what they're exposed to, where they live, the type of eating and drinking and exercise habits they have. These are all
the social determinants like stress.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so we are very complex creatures and we have very complex environments. And so there's no guarantee that if you're exposed to, X amount of PFAS that you're going to get cancer or you're going to have a suppressed immune system, but it does increase your risk of these. And we have a lot of data to show that. And so that's why we are working as hard as we can to reduce people's exposures as much as we can. And I think that that's something that is also really difficult for people is when you're faced with something that's scary, like what do you do, right? And the answer is as much as you can to reduce your exposure. That is good. You're never going to get to zero. It's not going to be perfect, and you shouldn't be stressing out about it to a level of to create a lot of anxiety. But if you can take measures to reduce your exposure to PFAS, that will benefit you and lower your risk of health harms associated with PFAS.
Well, that leads to a good point here, and something I think we want to emphasize in the remaining amount of our time. Let's see if I can do this step by step and quickly. So these chemicals are dangerous. They're chemicals of concern. Mm-hmm. And yet they're so pervasive. People say a total ban is impractical. And of course, different stakeholders have different reasons and different motives for saying that. You know, we mentioned the water and stain resistant qualities of PFAS. Mm-hmm. Well, imagine if you were a hospital worker and you have to do a surgery or some other procedure that's very messy. You would mm-hmm. want that. So I think it comes down to something that's this. Are there alternatives? What can we do to combat, and I do say combat, these chemicals? Mm-hmm. And if there, you know, people will ask, aren't there other chemicals that are safe and can do the same functions? I will mm-hmm. Hush up now, but I'll start off with a gift was given to us in 1987, the Montreal Protocol. Mm-hmm. And it talks about an essential use approach to this problem. If you could mm-hmm. just take it from there, I would appreciate it.
I'd love to. So the essential use approach did start in the Montreal Protocol, but it was really just at its nascency. It was, we knew that we were using refrigerants that were causing ozone depletion, and everybody agreed that's a really bad thing and we need to stop using them as quickly as possible. But being, you know, logical and trying to also understand that there were a few uses that there wasn't any safer alternative developed for, and if we just banned it outright without allowing for a time exemption, that that would cause serious problems, and either because the use was critical for health, safety, or functioning of our society, right? And so that's where it started, but that concept has really evolved over time in the scientific community as a way to address the fact that there are tens of thousands of chemicals in our economy now that are of concern, and we are not doing a good job of regulating them. So the idea is plainly that we shouldn't be using chemicals of concern unless absolutely necessary. But of course, somebody's interpretation, as you said before, of what is necessary or not is could be very different depending on who you're talking to. So there's been some work in developing criteria and a framework for that decision. And so that is what I worked with multiple other colleagues with over the last few years on, was how do we implement the essential use approach, especially, you know, for chemicals, like big chemical classes like PFAS. And we came down to three criteria. And basically for PFAS, which is definitely a chemical class of concern, you should only be allowed to use it if you meet all three criteria. And the three criteria are, is one, there's no safer alternative for the PFAS use. So if there is a safer alternative, there's no justification for continuing to use these chemicals. The second criteria is that the use of PFAS is needed for the product's primary function. This is to address when PFAS are used to provide kind of a performance function that's not necessarily core to the function of that product. So think stain-resistant couches. The primary function of a couch is for us to sit on it. It's not for it to be stain resistant. And so that's what that criteria addresses. It's great to have extra performance functions as long as it's not hurting our health and our environment. The third criteria is that the use of PFAS in that product is critical for health, safety, or functioning of society. This is a little bit more of the gray area of the concept, right? This has to do with our values as a society in some way. And we hope that as this concept is implemented, that it includes a broad stakeholder group and isn't just about what businesses think, but what regulators think and what community members think and what people who work with the chemicals think, right? But generally that is reserved for cases where we want to allow the use of a chemical of concern when there isn't a safer alternative, it's really required for that chemical, only if it's really critical for health or safety. So, you know, pacemakers or firefighter turnout gear, with those kinds of products where we can't just stop the functioning and use of those right away. Critical for this process, though, is that when you get an exemption because you are an essential use, that it's time bound. We can't have this decision be forever. We want these things change. There are safer alternatives developed all the time. And so, you know, if you're going to implement this idea, this approach, it needs to have a time bound component to it.
Just a brief interruption. So firefighting foam, for instance, there are substitutes for PFAS in developing a foam that extinguishes and smothers things. Would that be a good example, for instance?
It's a great example because 5 years ago, we were working on a legislation to ban PFAS and firefighting foam, and it was still considered, it is a product that is required for health and safety, right? But what we had to show was that there was a safer alternatives to PFAS in firefighting foam that were being used abroad, just not in the US. And so because those existed and they were being used successfully to put out real fires on like aircraft, that they could be used here in the US. And that was the only way we were able to make that switch, because those are really critical product for our health and safety. But we had to show that there was a safer alternative available, and that's how we were able to ban PFAS and firefighting foam.
Well, let's say more about the essential use approach. Is it indeed efficient? Is it indeed health protective? Mm-hmm. I'm begging the question here, obviously.
Yes. But. So currently, a lot of the ways we manage chemicals is we have to show that the use of the chemical is like how it's going to expose the population, and then we have to detail how that's putting people at risk. Here, we already know PFAS. There's enough data to know PFAS are of concern, that we shouldn't be using them. But then even if we treated all PFAS as a class, but then we went through and did regulation for one use at a time, we would be here for decades and we would not be protecting people on a time efficient manner. This allows us to take all the uses of PFAS and ban them by a certain date, and then require manufacturers to come to the agency that's in charge and ask for a time limited exemption because they meet those criteria. So it's a way, one, to reverse kind of the way we think and regulate PFAS and the way we regulate chemicals. We are asking manufacturers to show us that they can't get out of using a chemical of concern. That's not what we do now.
Yeah. Is it unfair to say that, I guess you're referring to the risk assessment approach that's established mm-hmm. pretty much by industry and government. I want to be fair here, but that's pretty much the truth. So you've already made the contrast between the two approaches, but I'm scratching my head here. Are we making progress into the essential use approach?
Some. It's newer. It's very hard to change the status quo and how we approach chemical management. Maine and Minnesota have already passed legislation to ban all PFAS unless they are currently unavoidable. Same thing as saying currently essential. Maine is the ban goes into effect in 2030, and Minnesota is 2032. We're currently part of a legislative effort in California to do the same thing, to ban the sale of any product, sale or distribution of any product in California that has PFAS, unless they get a exemption because they are currently unavoidable. So there is some progress, but it's a very big uphill climb. It's not something that businesses are generally in support of.
So we've talked about kind of a national action on the part of the EPA, and we've talked about state actions as well. Mm-hmm. This may be out of your purview or discipline, but one of the problematics is that we're so heavy on the globalization of product. How do we really stop this? That's really the honest question here.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the fundamental reasons why scientists and experts in the field are pushing this approach more, is because we have for far too long just assumed that a chemical is safe unless proven otherwise, and that really has not worked. In fact, many of the chemicals that we use in our economy now are petrochemicals. They're waste products of producing oil. And what we found is that petrochemicals in general, there's a high likelihood that they are harmful to our health or environment. And because we're starting from that already, assuming that chemicals that we use are safe unless proven otherwise is basically failed to protect public health and the environment. And so we need a drastic change in how we regulate chemicals, and the essential use concept is one. Treating chemicals as a class is another. And then also requiring a lot more evidence on in terms of health effects before a chemical is allowed on the market is another.
Allow me to reintroduce you. We're talking to Dr. Anna Reed. Dr. Reed is the director of PFAS Advocacy Environmental Health for the Natural Resources Defense Council, the NRDC. And we're talking about PFAS, the forever chemicals, properly understood as a chemical, or chemicals rather, of concern, those that pose dangerous or human health risk, such as cancer, reproductive or developmental harms, risk to wildlife and environment, domesticated animals, plants, and biodiversity, risk in accumulation and persistence and mobility, and contributing to, I'm not trying to be unfair, doctor, but such things like ozone depletion or climate change or unsafe water all the way around. And finally, if these chemicals present physical threats such as combustion or explosivity or flammability, that's what a chemical concern is. That's what PFAS fits under, unfortunately. They are the forever chemicals. So we're talking about, in your last remarks, just new ways of approaching fairness and equity and stability for all of us, for all of society. And if you could just lean in to the importance of stakeholders having participatory responsibilities and accountability to each other, that would be very helpful.
Yeah. PFAS are not the only area where the cost of the use and of these products that are produced are externalized to everyone else, right? So this is not a new concept, but it definitely is part of the PFAS problem. PFAS are used widely, and the people who make PFAS and who use PFAS in their products are not responsible for the consequences of producing and using PFAS. We are as people in terms of our health, but also taxpayers are in terms of cleaning up PFAS, ratepayers in terms of having to pay for water treatment. So having a broader stakeholder participation in making decisions around how these chemicals are used is critical, because we businesses are not the only ones that are affected by our decisions when it comes to PFAS. All of us are. Every single one of us basically has PFAS in our bodies. And we're at the point where, you know, PFAS transfer from mother to infant in the womb, right? So we are being born now with PFAS burdens. It is a universal issue that everybody has to deal with, because we didn't do a good job of controlling their use in the first place.
Well, let's extend your concern and our concern further. You worked in the California State Legislature. Mm-hmm. And you're part of an organization that has national and international perspective and concerns and responsibilities. I want to leave people with a note of what they need to grapple with, or what they need to hold on to. Is it plausible and possible to make this progress? I mean, in one way, what you've been saying in this hour is compelling, but in another, how do you see probably the way forward? I know that's generally a broad question, but if you could say a little bit more.
I think I will leave us with a positive note in that 5 years ago, I was working with community members in states across the country on setting drinking water standards at the state level. because we wholeheartedly believed that we were not going to get a federal drinking water standard, that it was not possible. And you know, a few weeks ago, we were proven wrong, right? The EPA set drinking water standards for the first time in 28 years. That is how much the movement has progressed on PFAS, and that's because of community members across the country working together with NGOs and scientists on this problem. And I will say, you know, I've seen the scientific community come out and be more aggressive and say like how concerned they are about this problem and offer solutions a lot more than I think they're typically comfortable with doing. But the problem has been so concerning that we are seeing like real involvement. So I think just the collaboration between all the people on the ground that are affected, between scientists, between regulators that really do are concerned and want to do the right thing, has made, has resulted in progress that I am really optimistic about. But we have a really long ways to go, and there's a lot of money involved. It makes it a lot more difficult to do the right thing to get what we need to be done as quickly as possible.
You know, I also want to. You're being modest with your work and the hard work of NRDC, and listeners, you can find out more at nrdc.org. Again, nrdc.org. I was going to say that in the battle and the engagement about PFAS, there does seem to be a good demonstration of professional and public juncture. It does seem that you have a diversity of stakeholders that is not just solely scientists or industry or government. And in many regards, I think that should give us hope.
I agree. Yeah. Working with the National PFAS Contamination and Coalition, has been really informative and keeping us grounded in what we're trying to do and keeping us motivated.
All right. Well, Dr. Anna Reed, again, let me just remind people, Dr. Reed is the Director of PFAS Advocacy, Environmental Health for the Natural Resources Defense Council. Thank you so much for spending this time with us and informing us of a very important concern. It's much appreciated.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
We've come to the end of the hour and the end of this show. I want to thank the News and Public Affairs Departments of WPFW. I want to thank Mike Nasella, our engineer for the hour, and who works hard throughout the whole day. Coming up next at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, Africa Now with host Moise Mutali. At 2, Shewanana with Zen El Amin covering Middle Eastern affairs. 3 p.m., Sophie's Parlor, the oldest women's collective in public broadcasting covering music and culture by women before everyone. And immediately following this broadcast is the news, 5 minutes before the hour, I believe. Sue Goodwin will bring that to you. And don't forget the blues. We do that every noontime with Clarence the Blues Man Turner hosting the Wednesday edition. I thank you for supporting WPFW, its many programs, and this station bringing you jazz and justice. And you're appreciated. Thank you for being with us in this hour. Perhaps we'll meet again on the radio sometime soon.
Greetings. WPFW presents Reversing the Mounting Healthcare Access Crisis for DC's Underserved, a radio forum on Unity Healthcare Clinics and the DC Jail, a special broadcast spotlighting the importance of community involvement and government support on Tuesday, July 9th, 6 to 8 p.m. Participants include Unity Healthcare providers representing their newly formed union, DC City Council members, community activists, and WPFW hosts. Produced in collaboration with the Union of American Physicians and Dentists, that's Reversing the Mounting Healthcare Access Crisis for DC's Underserved, a radio forum on the Unity Healthcare Clinics and the DC Jail. Tuesday, July 9th, 6 to 8 p.m. on WPFW. Building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
This July 4th, WPFW presents Let America Be America, From Midnight Until Midnight. Langston Hughes wrote in this epic 1936 poem, "There's never been equality for me, nor freedom in this homeland of the free. For millions of people in America, those words still ring true." Throughout the day, you'll hear music, activists, and artists, both contemporary and ancestors, who fought for freedom and who continue to resist. That's Let America Be America on WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Hi, this is Miyuki. On Sunday, July 7th, 4 to 8 p.m., WPFW is presenting a fundraising evening of roots, rock, reggae at Mango Cafe, 4719 Annapolis Road, Bladensburg, Maryland, featuring Proverbs reggae band with Z Lion and special guest Freedom and Soroma Liel. Proceeds to benefit WPFW.
Details at Eventbrite. WPFW reggae concert, eventbrite.com.
PACA, Pan-African Community Action, will be holding the community town hall, the harm of crime bills, and the future of community power in Chaka City. On Saturday, July 13th, from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m., D.C. residents are invited to discuss how the Secure D.C. crime bill targets the black working class and criminalizes our youth, and how to develop real people-centered solutions to community safety. There will be speakers, group exercises, lunch, and a performance by the Afro-Go-Go Roots Collective, Crank Lukongo Unplugged. The Harm of Crime Bills and the Future of Community Power in Chocolate City, Saturday, July 13th, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the RISE Demonstration Center, 2730 Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue, Southeast D.C. More information and registration can be found online, PACA, that's P-A-C-A, crimebilltownhall.eventbrite.com. WPFW is your station for jazz and justice, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Christina Onnested. President Joe Biden is facing renewed pressure to step down as his party's nominee for president following an abysmal debate with Donald Trump last week. Texas Congressman Lloyd Doggett is the first member of Congress to call for Biden to drop out. He spoke last night on CNN.
We would be better off if we had a new candidate who could present a new vision for our country. And we can do that if we have an open and fair democratic process over the next few weeks.
Catherine Carley has more.
White House officials will reportedly meet with Democratic governors today as calls mount for President Joe Biden to step aside from the race. Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer says he can still win her battleground state.
When Democrats lead and when President Biden is leading, our lives are getting better. Our standing in the world is getting better. And I think that's something all Americans benefit from.
Meanwhile, Texas Congressman Lloyd Doggett is the first sitting Democratic lawmaker to publicly call for Biden to withdraw. Longtime Biden supporter Congressman Jim Clyburn of South Carolina tells MSNBC he's sticking with the president, but he'd support Vice President Kamala Harris should Biden drop out.
This party should not in any way do anything to work around Ms. Harris. We should do everything we can to bolster her, whether it's in second place or at the top of the ticket.
Polls following the first debate show Trump with a narrow lead among registered voters. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
The resentencing of Donald Trump for some 34 felonies in his election interference hush money case is now postponed until at least September 18th as a presiding judge weighs the impacts from last week's Supreme Court ruling that grants presidents broad immunity from criminal prosecution. Trump was scheduled to face sentencing July 11th on his New York conviction. Some Democrats are calling for reforms to the Supreme Court in the wake of its ruling. Catherine Carley reports.
New York Democratic Congressman Joe Morelli says he'll introduce a constitutional amendment to reverse the ruling. He says no one, not even the president, is above the law.
There's no question that the president not only violated his oath of office, he precipitated an attack on the United States Capitol, on the Article I branch of government, the United States Congress. And I think there needs to be accountability for that.
In light of the decisions and numerous scandals, House Democrats are pushing Republican Speaker Mike Johnson to allow a